You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of April 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
I think it's good news that the President of the United States is coming to the UK. It is the most important strategic partnership relationship that we have, and altogether right that we should welcome the President of the United States.
UK Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson welcomes Donald Trump to Britain. Will anybody else? My guests Melkon Çarçoğlu and Ben Ryland and Marcus Hippie will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including a hopefully hopeful day on the border between the Koreas, a bewildering week of upheaval in Armenia with more likely to come, and has Venice reached the limits of its hospitality? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's Ben Ryland, Marcus Hippie and Melkon Çarçoğlu, and welcome all. And we start in Korea, which currently feels more like one country than it has in some time. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and his South Korean counterpart Moon Jae-in have met in person in the demilitarized zone between the two countries amid much symbolic choreography, including a handshake across the frontier and each briefly setting foot on the territory of the other's country. In a joint statement, the pair agreed to work towards a formal end of the state of war, which has existed between the two Koreas since the 1950s, and the denuclearization of the peninsula. Marcus, first of all, is this the absolute feel-good story it is being sold at? Is there any reason not to be optimistic?
I think there are some reasons not to be optimistic. First of all, we don't really know that much about Kim Jong-un and whether he can keep his promises. I think that's the big question. Secondly, there was a lot of symbolism, there was a lot of promises, but there isn't a lot of, there in our know at the moment, of what the next steps are going to be, when we are going to be seeing something tangible, something concrete. And also, considering that one of the reasons why Kim Jong-un promised to do this meeting, first of all, is maybe that North Korea at the moment has such a nuclear arsenal that he feels stronger. So that as well sheds a bit of doubt over the whole idea of denuclearization in the peninsula. I think we still need to wait quite a few months and see if this actually means something or whether we're going to go back to the same permafrost we've been witnessing for so long.
Ben, did we enjoy the diplomatic choreography, Kim Jong-un and in his immense trousers waddling towards the frontier, that handshake across the border in that strange little waltz between the two Koreas?
I think your choice of words is perfect, Andrew. Choreography. That's what this is, isn't it? It's like an elaborate stage musical. I don't necessarily believe any of the show business so far. I think the reign of Kim Jong-il shows that North Korea is more than capable of putting on a good show, whether it's a diplomatic show, whether it's a show of fear and fire and fury, to use someone else's words, or whether it's an actual show of complete fiction, as Kim Jong-il was so famously fond of. Kim Jong-un, I don't think, is any different in that respect. He knows he's putting on a show for the international stage, and so far I think it's going quite well. Everything seems to have become a big show of goodwill. There's not a lot of negative publicity going on at the moment, but things behind the scenes, how much has actually changed? How much have lives changed for the everyday person in North Korea? Absolutely nothing whatsoever. Is anyone less afraid? Well, perhaps outside of North Korea, yes, but inside, I don't think anything's changed yet.
Exactly. That's what I was saying earlier as well. But we're talking about choreography. I think it's really interesting how immaculately this whole event was organized. I was reading about the menu, for example, that these two leaders enjoyed. And for example, Kim Jong-un
was worried that you're about to say the menu, which is, of course, the same name as my show, which I host, Monocle 24.
I didn't think to promote it this time. But I think it's interesting that Kim Jong-un
was
about
56 minutes, isn't it?
Exactly. Kim Jong-un was served Swiss rusty because it's believed that he actually did a study in Switzerland. Obviously, we don't still know much more. Maybe he enjoys something else better, like raclette or fondue. Who knows? But anyway, that's what he got served. Some other interesting things.
Couldn't serve fondue at a diplomatic lunch. It's too messy, Marcus.
Kim Jong-un may like it messy, actually.
I'll have raclette anywhere,
It would get everywhere.
But amazing small details. For example, this table these leaders gathered around at was 2018 millimeters wide. That was a precise figure to refer to this year. This pine tree that these world leaders planted together was from 1953, which is another year that has a lot of significance for these two countries. Then both these leaders brought some sand or some land from their own countries, placed it under this pine tree, and all these small things. There must have been so much stuff that was thought through before this meeting actually took place. It's astonishing.
Malcolm, is there a danger in the press coverage that it gets a little bit too forgiving of Kim Jong-un, lest we forget he is the supreme leader of what is almost certainly the world's worst regime?
Absolutely. I think if you turn away from the main article and go to, say, the comments section of any article... That's never a good idea. People are arguing, of course, but people are incredibly suspicious. How has a regime known for its cruelty and almost draconic suppression of the liberties of its people suddenly become good overnight? This sort of fairy tale transformation. And the symbolism is very nice, but I think it is drawing people's attention away from the real question. What is North Korea going to do? Is it suddenly going to accept all these sorts of technological and humanitarian advances from its neighbor and say, okay, we're you now, we're on the same level, let's crack on? Or will it try to retain something of its nature and status quo?
Looking further ahead to the future, if Kim Jong-un was to allow some significant improvement between these relations between these two countries, that would mean that North Koreans would feel some kind of a change in their lives possibly as well. And I don't think Kim Jong-un would want that, because that would on some level threaten his position in power. If North Koreans realize that, well, something else is going on in another country and actually it may not be quite as bad as we have been told for the whole of our lives, that is going to threaten Kim Jong-un. So I think he wants to keep North Korea as isolated as it's always been.
Absolutely. But I think part of that problem is that if there were to be a change in people's quality of life in North Korea, then that would mean that Kim Jong-un would have to admit that there's a problem in the first place. And I think we all remember that report that came out some years ago from Michael Kirby that was heading up that panel. And he compared the atrocities going on in North Korea to what happened in Nazi Germany. And that's not an exaggeration by any means. So we all know that this is exactly what's happening there. So if something is to change, he would need to admit there is a problem. He's not going to do that. So I think that's why a lot of experts have trouble with remaining optimistic about all of this.
Just a final thought, Malcolm, and by way of wrapping this up to seamlessly cue us into the next item, is it a karmic trade-off we are willing to make? The prospect of peace on the Korean Peninsula, which results somehow in Donald Trump winning the Nobel Prize for Peace?
Well, I mean, you know what? The Nobel Prize, do people really invest that much significance into it anymore? He would. But it is a PR stunt nowadays, a Nobel Prize, so he can have it.
Not always. Finland won it quite recently, former president.
That was the last legitimate victory.
No one cares, Marcus. but moving along on the subject of the great peace bringer, it has been confirmed that President Donald Trump will visit the United Kingdom in July. This visit has been long awaited, especially by British retailers of eggs, flour, tomatoes and the materials necessary to the construction of abusive placards. It has not yet been confirmed where in the UK Trump will visit, though the British government would doubtless prefer he be confined largely to the remoter islets of the Outer Hebrides. It seems unlikely that they can altogether avoid a confrontation between Trump and the people of the capital. Marcus, on which subject? Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London, tweeted, "If he comes to London, President Trump will experience an open and diverse city that has always chosen unity over division and hope over fear. He will also no doubt see that Londoners hold their liberal values of freedom of speech very dear." Now, obviously, Donald Trump has taken a couple of cheap pops at Sadiq Khan in the past. Should Sadiq Khan have risen above this temptation?
I don't know. I think it's really obvious that he was going to write that, considering that there's been quite significant tensions between Mr. Khan and Mr. Trump. And also, let's indeed remember what Donald Trump has been saying about London, for example, that there are no-go zones in this city, for example. And
he might end up thinking that that is the case.
Actually, that's a very good point.
Well, let's make sure Westminster is none
also,
of that.
Also, the idea we have of Donald Trump at the moment is that he's a massive sexist and a racist as well. That's what it looks like. So it is a bit predictable from Sadiq Khan, but what else should he have tweeted, considering that he's not in the government and the British government at the moment seems to be very keen to have Donald Trump in this country for reasons we may discuss later. Sadiq Khan is not that involved in that kind of politics when it comes to international relations. He's more concerned about London and how Londoners feel.
Ben, there will of course be large protests against Trump's visit should he come to London. Am I alone in thinking it would be far funnier if just nobody turned up at all?
Yeah, that would be quite funny, but it's also unrealistic. I mean, this is Donald Trump. He feeds off attention, but I do think people have a right to be quite outraged that about his existence in general, really. I mean, let's not forget, as Marcus just hinted at there, that he is a racist, he is a sexist, but he's also been accused multiple times by multiple women of assault. And I think if we can imagine Harvey Weinstein doing some sort of celebrity tour around the world, would people be okay with that? Or Kevin Spacey, Matt Lauer, Charlie Rose? You know, these are all people from not exactly the same bucket, but from what? The same sea, at least. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's a lot of outrage simply from that side of things. I think we in the media tend to look at this as a bit of a political story only, but it's not just that. I think we're underestimating the absolute simmering rage that a lot of people are feeling from that side of Donald Trump.
When it comes to this country, or when it comes to many other European countries, I've actually never seen anything like this before. It seems that at the moment in the UK, there are quite a few groups that have been on standby. They've been waiting for this moment because they want to get as many people as possible on the streets to demonstrate against Donald Trump. So I think we can quite safely imagine that we're going to be seeing a huge number of people on the streets when Donald Trump is here.
Malcolm, we heard a clip at the top of the Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson welcoming the President of the United States to London. It is worth remembering that it's not so long ago that Boris Johnson was being quite flagrantly dismissive of Donald Trump as both a human being and a politician. This was, of course, before he got elected. But how overjoyed, really, do you think the British government are at the prospect of hosting Donald Trump? I mean, they know this is going to be an absolute circus, don't they?
It's like hosting your boss over for dinner. You're not looking forward to the experience. You have to sit there and pour your best red wine and laugh at his jokes. But at the end, you know you're going to profit. I mean, there are so many relationships that need to be maintained between the US and the UK. And I don't understand the crowd's righteous indignation. Far worse people have visited the UK. Saudi royals, for example.
The president of Azerbaijan today, in fact.
There we go. I mean, heads of state... The countries which they manage, for example, our late Education Secretary Justine Greening, she would have been executed in somewhere like Saudi Arabia for her sexual orientation. But we happily welcome Saudi royals and host them at UK tables, and people don't go marching in the streets because of them.
But some people do. I think some people do march in the streets about
some
about
people
those countries.
Do. But I mean, Malcolm's point is a fair one, that this will get a much bigger crowd. But is that the fact? Well, down to the fact that basically by this point, we know that Saudi Arabia is what Saudi Arabia is. It's like demonstrating against the sun coming up in the morning, whereas the United States, we have come to expect better of, or we like to expect better of.
We like to expect better of, but we know exactly what the score is. I just think it's the fact that Trump is overt, excessively overt in his racism and his incredibly outdated views. Whereas, for example, if we hosted Mike Pence, I don't think there'd be many crowds at all, even though he is arguably a worse individual.
Is that a makeable case? I'm not saying you'd live long on the difference, but I do think Donald Trump is worse both as a politician and as a person. Marcus, Woody Johnson, the American ambassador to the United Kingdom, has described the president as thick-skinned. on what evidence do we think he is basing that assessment? Because I've looked and I can't find any.
I have absolutely, absolutely no idea what he's basing that on. I think he was just made to say something to make it seem like Donald Trump is seeming stronger when he's coming to the UK. I don't know how we are going to be. I think it's going to be a very, very interesting day. I'm thinking about what the government is thinking at the moment, how they're getting prepared for that day so that they can keep on smiling and kind of secretly at the same time hoping that it's not going to get all awkward.
Ben, I don't know, it is Donald Trump. They might get away with it. If they told him that the capital of the United Kingdom had been relocated to the Shetland Islands. but in all seriousness, how can they actually handle this? Because obviously, all jokes aside, the British government will just want to get this over with as fast as they possibly can. And they will want to, I guess, make whatever deference and enact whatever protocols are the bare minimum necessary to the President of the United States. And they will want as minimal disruption as possible, because there is no electoral advantage to any British politician in being photographed with the President of the United States at the moment. What actually is the smart thing for them to do?
I think they should take a leaf out of Emmanuel Macron's book, because he is someone who has managed to appear alongside Donald Trump in a way that does not suggest to anyone that he's actually on Trump's side. Macron is someone who's putting himself forward right now.
I think
now.
It suggests it to Trump.
It suggests it to Trump, and that's all that matters. And I mean, Trump is gullible enough to fall for that kind of rubbish. But we all know, we can all look at that and say, oh, look, isn't Macron such a statesman? He can handle this raging lunatic. You know, and I think that shows what an effective politician he is. I think that's actually a very positive thing, because for the time being, Trump is someone that we're stuck with. You know, we can't do anything about the fact that he was elected and he's in charge of America for the time being. So we just need someone out there who's capable of handling him. Is Boris Johnson or Theresa May that person? Probably not.
I'm wondering if I was Theresa May, something I actually think about regularly. No, if I was in charge of this state visit, I would make Donald Trump to fly to an obscure airport somewhere. No information would be revealed beforehand.
Steady on.
And then this meeting, this visit would take place maybe in Scotland, because Donald Trump has got some connections to that part of the country.
Well, he owns parts of it.
Exactly. Yeah. This meeting would take place somewhere in Scotland. Somewhere in a place that has some symbolic importance, but it's not very big, and it would be revealed like 30 minutes before the meeting would actually take place that Donald Trump is going to be there, so that all the Londoners would not have time to go there.
But oh, we missed him.
Final thought on this, Malcolm, to go back to where we came in. Should Sadiq Khan turn up and shake his hand as Mayor of London?
I think I'm going to be with Marx on this one. He's not involved in that sphere of politics. He has nothing to gain from it. But he has a lot to lose, because suddenly his constituents would say, well, you're an incredibly two-faced man.
Does not protocol override that? He is the mayor of the capital. He has the largest personal mandate of any politician in this country.
But does he need to engage with Donald Trump on such an active level?
It'd be interesting to see how
that... He's not a world leader. You know, he's not a world leader. I think he's a city mayor. That's an important job, but he doesn't need to be meeting the president.
Okay, well, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Malcolm Çarçoğlu and Ben Ryland and Marcus Hippie. Coming up next, an eventful week in Armenia.
Our very own Monocle Library is growing into a robust collection of well-turned-out titles. For an in-depth look into our core theme of quality of life, why not delve into our first-ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living? For any would-be business leaders, entrepreneurs, or even established companies in search of fresh ideas, there's the Monocle Guide to Good Business. In How to Make a Nation, a Monocle Guide, we look at the small and the big things that can help make our nations work better. And in the Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining, we bypass the foam and the fuss to uncover the makings of a truly great meal. Monocle's handsome books are published by our friends at Gestalten in Berlin and offer a world of new experiences between the covers. So spruce up your shelves today and buy some of our titles online at monocle.com or from any good bookstore.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Melkin Çarçoğlu, Marcus Hippie and Ben Rylan. And let's look at Armenia, which has already had two prime ministers in the last week, and they may not be the last. Former President Serge Sargsyan tried to install himself in the role, which prompted protests, which led him to quit in favour of his immediate predecessor, Karen Karapetian. However, the opposition figure who led the protests, Nikol Pashinyan, says there will be still further demonstrations after Karapetian refused to meet him to discuss a transfer of power. Melkin, the obvious person here for us to turn to, given that your surname is Çarçoğlu and everything, and from that we are going to extrapolate a vast and we're going to assume a vast and wide-ranging knowledge of the history and present state of Armenia. Basically, what is going on here?
So, in a very blunt constitutional reform, in order to stay in power, the former president, Serge Sargsyan, he recreated the country in a more republican format so that he could become prime minister and effectively maintain power.
He was trying to pull the Putin maneuver, wasn't he?
Precisely.
You run out of time as president, so you make yourself prime minister and turn the presidency into an irrelevance.
Exactly. Even people as, you know, old and old-fashioned as my dad could see there was a blunt power grab. And the people were having none of it. And I was very proud and very surprised because normally Armenia is a very kind of politically dormant as far as the citizens go. People don't really engage on a political level. Corruption just happens on the streets and every day, and people just go along with it because they think that that is the status quo and that's how things will always remain. But led by Pashinyan, they are trying to take things back in a more democratic direction.
A couple of questions about Pashinyan. One, which I know we discussed in the office yesterday because I was seeking guidance as vis-a-vis this weird camouflage T-shirt he keeps turning up for meetings in, as if he fancies himself as some sort of guerrilla commander. And the other is, he seems to assume that he is now entitled to be prime minister, whereas it's my understanding he didn't actually get that much of the vote at the last election.
No, so he represents the minority opposition. And yes, his party is not hugely popular, but what he is saying is that if we have a prime minister who represents the ruling government, nothing will ever change. And he's saying that either he will be elected prime minister or no one will be. It's taking that sort of direction, which is a bit worrying.
That does sound like kind of a threat.
I don't understand how he's going to enact that. I mean, he needs to be voted in by his fellow members of parliament. They are, I believe, 6 votes short or 5 votes short. I mean, so, you know, 5 Republican members of parliament would have to defect to his side, which is highly unlikely. Although several news sources, including The Guardian, have said that he is likely to be elected prime minister on Tuesday. So I don't understand how he wants to force the boundaries of the law to get himself elected.
What is the deal with the T-shirts?
Well, I said to you initially that in Armenia, people don't really think about fashion so much. People just wear what they have. But he's been wearing it so frequently that I doubt a grown man could only have one T-shirt. I think he is trying to present himself as a sort of Che Guevara figure. And to be honest, he has become the people's man. I was just watching him give a speech in Gyumri, which is one of the major cities in the north of the country. His voice was hoarse. He was actually losing his voice as he was delivering the speech. But again, the square, which is the same size as the main square in Yerevan, was packed with people. He has the popular support. And don't forget, this is a small country. So what you see on TV is very much an adequate representation of the masses.
I'm just wondering, like, I've been following this news story and I find it, I'm slightly delighted that what we saw happening was that Serge Sargsyan actually understood to resign. Did he really have any alternatives? Because he could have tried to stay in power and this whole thing could have got a lot messier.
Well, I'm going to say something which might not be totally popular or correct, but let's not forget that these protests were taking place at the same time as the genocide remembrance day, and obviously even the lead up to the remembrance day is an incredibly important time in Armenia. So to try to suppress the people with military force at a time when you're trying to commemorate the genocide, and much of Armenia's soft power or kind of foreign political mandate relies on saying we have been mistreated in the past, our country has been destroyed over the course of a century, we want justice for the genocide. To then, on the eve of remembrance, turn around and suppress the populace, I can't imagine something worse for an active government. No one would have stood by Sargsyan.
I'm intrigued at the role of Russia in this because, from what I understand, when this started to boil over, Russia sent in a flurry of diplomacy to try and calm the situation and I suppose, try and ensure that the aftermath was at least something that could fall into their own favour. But it strikes me that this is not a situation that Russia historically knows how to handle very well. There was, of course, the aftermath of what happened in Ukraine, where Russia had a very deep misunderstanding as to how to handle that sort of situation. I mean, this is sort of like democracy at work in many ways, isn't it? And that's not something Russia can really handle.
Well, Russia's not opposed to democracy. So I'll let Andrew jump in. Oh, I'll continue. Russia's not opposed to democracy per se. It's opposed to anti-Russian views. But, you know, the current Armenian agenda is not Russia or not Russia. Russia will always remain, you know, Armenia's bigger brother. Armenia has no choice but to be in its sphere of influence.
Okay, well, finally tonight to Venice, which has long been one of those places that tourists complain is overrun by tourists. This coming weekend, expected to be one of the year's busiest, city authorities have decided to act. Temporary regulations will direct pedestrian and water traffic in such a manner that tourists are less likely to get in the way of people attempting to live there. Certain areas of Venice will only be accessible to residents. Ben, can you really, like, live in Venice and then complain that there's loads of tourists?
Oh, yeah, for sure. You can complain. I would complain, and I've been there as a tourist. I complain about the tourists. I complain about myself. No, it's...
Did you really, like, stomp around St. Mark's Square going, why don't I go back to where I came from?
I mean, it's a beautiful city, but it's a city that feels like a theme park now. I think anyone that has been to Venice will know that. But I think it's a really tricky issue because we hear about this in the context of Barcelona a lot, where the city starts to take a bit of a menacing view towards tourists. And it's a very, very tricky issue to handle because on one hand, you do want to control tourists because everyone wants to control the number of people that are in any place. That's what, I mean, in another completely different context, that's what immigration is all about, isn't it?
But doesn't it control itself? I mean, we live in London, which is a massively touristed city, and there are parts of London which locals never go anywhere near and that only tourists go to.
But in London, there are banks here and there are big companies and there are all sorts of reasons to be in London. In Venice, there's only a few reasons to be there. The Venice Film Festival, the Venice Biennale, most of them have to do with tourism. There's not that many people who are living there and just buying their bread and contributing to the local economy.
Exactly, Andrew. You ask if you can really live in Venice and complain about tourists. Many people have decided not to do that. And actually, I was just checking the figures. There was about 175,000 people living there about 70 years ago. Now the population is about 55,000. So many people have made that decision.
How does Finland handle its annual influx of 27 tourists who arrive on one weekend that the sun comes out?
Interestingly enough, obviously, like, not that many people still go there, but Helsinki-Vantaa Airport has actually got really busy recently. And I remember being slightly annoyed by the number of foreigners at that airport when I was trying
Venice.
To find my way out.
And everyone's moving out.
Last time I went there.
I mean, Malcolm, do you have any experience of going somewhere like as Ben did to Venice and complaining about yourself?
Yes. Well, Rome is one example. Because you go to Rome for the escapism, for the romance of Rome, to feel like you're really in Italy. But then you're standing outside a bar paying, you know, about 10 euros for an Aperol Spritz, and you're thinking, and you're surrounded by Australians, and you're thinking, what this isn't Rome?
Like you say
what
that
am
like
I doing?
You say that like
no,
it's
I'm
a
just,
bad thing.
Fine, it could be any other country. You're surrounded by Brits.
You're not surrounded by
Italians.
You're surrounded by Australians right now.
Oh, God, I didn't realize. I thought you were from New Zealand. And on that note...
We'll sort this out in the car park afterwards.
I was just thinking about which other places I've been to that have had, in my opinion, too many tourists. I remember going to Prague one summer and I felt like that city had wrong kind of tourists who'd gone there just
the
for
wrong
cheap,
kind of tourists,
just
Marcus.
for cheap
would,
beer.
Would you like to expand on that outrageously snobbish generalization?
I think when you travel somewhere, you have to have some kind of appreciation for the local culture. Try to discover something about the local culture instead of just going there because beer is cheap. I mean, I've been going to Tallinn quite a few times, and I remember back in the day, Finns used to go there just because it was cheap over there. It was cheap to drink, and they would behave badly. But then, luckily, from the Finnish point of view, Ryan. There an EasyJet opened direct routes from London Luton and Stansted airports, and all of a sudden we got British stag and hen parties over there, and all of a sudden things were fine.
If there's a cheap flight, the Brits will go there.
I think part of the problem here is that we get pop-up cities, and a lot of people will go to these destinations when the weather is nice and when it's the holiday season and so on. And then as soon as that drops away, then the economy disappears. And that's what no one wants. But people, I think, have been responding to these sorts of things, and they've become more adventurous. I find that a lot of people who go on holidays today, they don't just think about the main destinations anymore. And I think part of that is because Airbnb, for example, has opened up ideas of where you can go, and you can visit all of these very far-flung places and actually find accommodation. And sure, the hotel industry is suffering to some extent because of that, but at the same time, it's a bit of a wake-up call to them to, you know, try and be better.
Well, that does bring us to the end of today's show. Ben Ryland, Marcus Hippy and Melkin Charchoglian, and thanks all for coming in. The show was produced by Augustin Macellari, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Louis Harnett O'Mara. Our studio manager was George McDonough. More music next at 1900. It's The Menu with Marcus Hippy. There's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. I'll be your host for that as well. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Have a great weekend.